From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. On the show today, how 50,000 new jobs at Amazon could affect Boston's tech ecosystem.
A lot of us have been worrying that there will be a brain drain, that Amazon's just going to come in here and kind of steal all of the engineers.
Also, growing concerns over youth tackle football.
We then drop them off in a playing field when they're 6, 7 years old and put a big plastic helmet and face mask on them and say, go at it.
The head of Pop Warner Little Scholars responds. And filmmaker Ken Burns.
I think that Americans have really not dealt with Vietnam. And when we have, we just told stories about ourselves. And we have done what wars do, which is objectify the other almost to the point that they disappear.
A conversation with Burns on the conclusion of his series on the Vietnam War. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we're going to start today with news that the alleged head of the MS-13 gang on the East Coast is being charged with conspiracy in Boston federal court. WBR Shannon Dooling is covering this story, and she's with us now in the studio. Hi there, Shannon.
Hi, Meghna.
So first and foremost, who is this person and what is he being charged with?
His name is Edwin Manica Flores. He's 35 years old. He's been charged with conspiracy to operate an enterprise operation, so it's commonly referred to as RICO charges. And prosecutors say he's the El Salvador-based leader of the East Coast branch of MS-13. And as such, he's allegedly coordinated things like phone calls among different MS-13 leaders of these local groups, what are called cliques. Mm-hmm. And so the indictment goes on to mention this one particular phone call that the government actually secretly recorded. And in that call, Manica Flores identifies himself as, quote, sugar from the Everett Locos. And that's the name of the Everett clique of MS-13. On that call, he encouraged members of MS-13's East Coast network, and these are members all the way from Boston to Houston, Texas, to Columbus, Ohio, and Virginia. And on the call, he encouraged them to increase local recruitment and to start generating more money so that it could be sent back to the gang leadership in El Salvador.
Interesting. Okay. So, Shannon, let's take a step back here. How extensive is MS-13 in the Boston area?
Well, it's kind of tough to say, but there are a number of established cliques that law enforcement have identified, including the Everett Locos, of which Manica Flores is supposedly a founding member. And according to this big indictment last year, there are also groups operating in East Boston, Chelsea, Somerville, Lynn, and Revere.
Okay, so about that big indictment, it was what, 61 or so
That's
alleged
right.
members of MS-13?
That's right. 61 alleged MS-13 members are listed on this indictment. There was this major sweep last year. It involved local, state, and federal agencies, and they basically went door to door and did a sweep of alleged MS-13 members. Some of the crimes charged in that massive indictment are, again, conspiracy, but there's also mentioned of like pretty brutally violent methods to intimidate people and to scare people. And we should say that's a really important tool for this gang is fear. There are 6 murder charges and 12 attempted murder charges. There are weapons charges, as well as drug trafficking of cocaine, marijuana, and heroin.
Mm. Now, many people probably know that MS-13 has been a focus of many members of the Trump administration. And in fact, Attorney General Jeff Sessions was just recently in Boston speaking to federal law enforcement officials here in the city. And he specifically spoke about the threat of MS-13.
He did. He mentioned them by name several times. And he painted a really dark picture of this gang's violence and the sort of large scale of its U.S. operation. Let's take a listen.
As this community knows firsthand, MS-13 is probably the most violent and ruthless gang on our streets today. It has made inflicting gruesome violence a primary feature of theirs. Their motto is kill, rape, and control. MS-13 has assaulted, raped, maimed, and killed, often just for the sake of it. In so doing, they've destroyed communities, the lives of hardworking and law-abiding immigrants, and left devastation and misery in their wake.
Yeah, so pretty bleak. Sessions, you know, did commend local law enforcement for that large-scale sweep that we talked about. And he said it was a great example of how to really get at how to attack this international criminal organization.
Okay, so today we're talking about this indictment of Edwin Manca Flores, allegedly the head of MS-13 on the East Coast. But do we expect to see more of the large-scale indictments in the future?
It's possible. I mean, Sessions definitely says it's a priority. It's important to note, though, that these particular charges, you know, came together well before Sessions was in office, of course. But we're waiting to hear back right now from local chiefs of police to get a sense of whether these arrests are really making an impact in their communities.
That's WBUR's Shannon Dooling bringing us up to speed on today's announcement of an indictment of the alleged head of MS-13 on the East Coast, an indictment being filed in Boston federal court. Shannon, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, let's talk more now about kids and football. Last week, we spoke with Dr. Robert Stern. He's director of clinical research at BU's Chronic Traumatic Encephalopathy Center, and he'd at that time just released a new study about the long-term brain and health effects of subconcussive impacts for people who play tackle football before they were 12 years old. Dr. Stern had found that those players had a higher chance of cognitive and emotional regulation challenges later in life. So last week I asked Stern, should young kids even be playing tackle football now at all? And here's what he said.
Where I am now is making sure that parents and everyone understands that kids benefit from taking part in youth sports. But am I at a point to say kids shouldn't be hitting their heads repeatedly until a certain age? Yeah, I'm there.
Well, more than 1.2 million young people do play tackle football in the United States. So we wanted to get the view from the largest youth football league in the United States. That's Pop Warner. John Butler joins us now. He's executive director of Pop Warner Little Scholars. John Butler, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Well, thanks for having me.
Really appreciate you joining us today. And I guess first and foremost, what's your reaction to what you just heard Dr. Stern say? He says he's at the point where he says kids before a certain age shouldn't be playing tackle football at all.
Well, it's kind of interesting. And right there in your neighborhood, Dr. Peter Cummings, who's also at BU, wrote an article recently. He said, I'm a brain surgeon, and I let my son play football. There's a tremendous amount of really interesting research going on about concussions, about prevention, detection, treatment, and so forth. And a couple of these recent studies, like the one Dr. Stern just cited and one he came out with in July, saying 110 out of 111 brains of former NFL players have CTE, neither of those studies are peer-reviewed. They are self-selected subjects. There is no control group at all. So it's a very one-sided study. And I think, you know, kind of, you know, somewhat misleading, actually, to the public. And I mean, at this point, because of studies like that, the media is far out ahead of the science. The science is saying there's a lot we don't know. We know a lot more now than we did 5 years ago, but 5 years from now we'll know a whole lot more than we know now.
You know, I take your point on that, because we have to let the science evolve as it will on its own timeline. But you know, we are hearing a lot more from, you know, even former NFL players now who are saying that they're cautious about the idea of letting their kids play. I mean, what are you hearing from Pop Warner parents about these studies and all this discussion about head injuries and young tackle football players?
Certainly parents are concerned, and rightfully so. I mean, I'm a parent too. But there's no perspective on this versus other sports or other kids' activities. There have been, you know, no studies of you know, what happens in soccer and lacrosse and bicycle riding and skateboarding and rollerblading. It's all the focus has been directed at football. And, you know, the chances of a child getting a concussion playing Pop Warner are very small. And, you know, I am not in any way minimizing or making light of concussions in any way at all. But there's also a lot of former NFL players who, you know, for everyone who has severe effects, there's multiples more who don't. And, you know, I look at the history of Pop Warner. This is our 89th year in existence. We have an estimated 10 million alumni. And, you know, as far as we know, you know, long-term, no ill effects in at least you know, if not all, I can't say 100%, but I think we would have heard something mm-hmm. by now.
You know, Pop Warner, though, has made recent changes to rules in terms of how the game is played and even equipment. And I was wondering if you could walk us through some of those. Like, I'm
sure.
seeing here, first of all, like last season, you eliminated kickoffs in order to reduce those real high-speed impacts between players.
It actually started in 2010. We were the first nationally used sports organization in any sport to institute our own concussion rule, which is real simple. It says any suspected concussion, the participant must be removed, cannot return to participation until signed off on by a trained medical professional. 2012, we were the first football organization at any level to limit the type and amount of contact allowed at practice. In 2013, we began requiring all of our coaches to take the heads-up football training. And in 2016, we did eliminate kickoffs for our three youngest age groups, and we further reduced the amount of time allowed for contact in practice.
Hmm. And have you made, are there equipment changes that have been made or could be made as well?
Certainly the helmets are evolving. The reality is, no helmet will ever completely eliminate concussions. Helmets were made primarily to prevent skull fractures, lacerations, and so forth, and it's the brain moving inside the skull that causes the concussion.
Mm.
Having said that, certainly they've improved a great deal and are much better at distributing any force over a broader area and therefore reducing the severity of it.
Yeah. So I want to play another piece of tape again from our conversation last week with Dr. Stern, because he referenced another study, one that he wasn't directly involved with, out of Wake Forest, where they looked at the total number of hits that youth football players had taken over the course of a season. And Dr. Stern summarized what this Wake Forest study found.
They looked at the relationship between the total number of hits the kids got above a certain force and changes in the integrity of the white matter of their brain. Sadly, what they found was this very strong relationship. The more hits kids got, youth football, the greater the change in the structures of their brain over just one season of play.
So, John Butler, we just talked about the rules changes that Pop Warner has taken on in order to reduce the number of hits and the force of hits that young players have. But when parents hear things like that from Dr. Stern, or maybe even read studies like what came out of Wake Forest, or when you read those studies, are you concerned that youth football may be heading towards something of a crisis, that just you'll reach a point where not that many parents want to risk having their kids play at a really young age?
No, there's no question. And again, I do think the media is far out ahead of the science, because Dr. Stefan Duma from Virginia Tech University did a study when we made our rules changes in 2012 with the scientists from Wake Forest, and found that Pop Warner kids in practice were getting 50% fewer hits to the head than non-Pop Warner programs because of our rules changes. We know that Daedalus Institute did a study on studying Pop Warner programs versus non-Pop Warner programs, and found that in practice, Pop Warner programs have 87% fewer overall injuries and 76% fewer concussions versus non-Pop Warner programs that don't do the same training.
Mm. You know, I've spoken a lot with parents and professionals who constantly remind us, importantly, about all the benefits of kids who play sports, and team sports especially, you know, the being physically active, learning how to work with others, leadership, things like that. And that has to be acknowledged. But I wonder, you know, is it possible to see a future where, you know, maybe as the studies continue, if they do, finding outcomes that they do, I mean, could Pop Warner potentially end up maybe one day become a league where tackling isn't done at all?
It's possible. I mean, we've continued to make changes, but only in step with the science. You know, the doctors on our medical advisory committee remind us that, you know, you can't act in advance of the science. So we are actually testing with USA Football this year in one of our leagues in Texas, a program that may become an introductory or intermediate step. They call it rookie tackle, and there's It is tackle football, but it's played 7 versus 7 on a smaller field. There are no three-point stances, no kickoffs, no punts. So we're looking very closely at that. And, you know, as the game evolves and continues to evolve, we'll certainly do our best to stay on the front edge of that. I mean, if you look back over the 150 years that football has been played, there has been tremendous evolution over that time, and there will continue to be.
Well, John Butler is the executive director of Pop Warner Little Scholars. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Following Tuesday's preliminary election, Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson is officially the challenger, looking to unseat incumbent Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks has this personal profile of Jackson, the first African-American mayoral finalist in Boston in more than 3 decades.
On a blustery morning, Tito Jackson stands on the corner of Center Street and Columbus Ave in Roxbury, greeting passersby and calling out to commuters and school bus drivers.
Good morning. Have a good day.
At 6'2" and 200-plus pounds and a ready smile, Jackson still cuts the figure of the high school football player he once was. But the city councilor is running hard not to win football games, but to bring change to the city of Boston, to make it work for all of its residents.
I want people to be able to still live in this neighborhood, not get pushed out of the neighborhood and community that they built up, that they made safe.
Back in 1991, when Jackson was 15, there were 151 murders in Boston, many of them in this part of the city where he grew up. But the community came together with clergy, city hall, and police, and now Roxbury is a very different place.
$200 increases in rent, good to see you, are pushing people out. There are developers who are buying whole buildings and emptying them out and not realizing those are people. Those are families. Same thing in South Boston. Same thing in East Boston. They're getting pushed out, too. Good to see you.
Jackson complains about a city with a booming economy and enormous wealth, with the widest wealth gap in the nation and dramatic racial disparities. Jackson inherited his progressive politics from his parents. His dad, Herb Jackson, was a community activist who sponsored registration drives to help elect candidates of color in Boston and pressured city construction companies to hire local and minority workers. Tito Jackson describes his dad as a major force in his life.
When you're a young person, you always think, no, I'm not going to be just like my dad. You know what? I am my dad. He fought every single day for the uplift of everybody in Boston. What he instilled, and my mom instilled, is that we're not doing great as a city if we leave significant portions of people behind.
Herb Jackson died in 2002, but Jackson's mother, Rosa, is still a big presence in his life.
When he was young, I have to tell you this story.
Rosa Jackson lives in Florida, but is back in Boston helping with her son's campaign. Rosa and Herb Jackson had 8 kids, 4 of them adopted, including Tito. Rosa Jackson recalls urging her young son to talk about that fact for a school project.
So we put together a little book for him with pictures of different ages, and I helped him present it. All the kids in the class were so excited. Tito was adopted? I want to be adopted too, because we told them that Tito was special. He was chosen to be in the Jackson family.
So Jackson grew up knowing he was adopted, but not until he was a young man did he learn of the difficult circumstances that led to his birth.
My biological mother was 13 years old, and she was assaulted by 2 guys. And that's how I got here.
So this 13-year-old girl, your birth mother, what do you think about her?
I want to meet her someday, and I just want to say thank you. One of the most important parts about the work that I do is redefining manhood, that is anti-sexual violence, that says we can love each other.
Jackson learned about his birth mother when he was in college, which he says provided a pivotal opportunity. He'd hoped to go to Morehouse, the historically black college in Atlanta, but didn't get enough financial aid. So he ended up at the overwhelmingly white University of New Hampshire, and recalls his first day on campus this way.
We all went to where all of the freshmen were meeting. And I'm talking to someone, so I back into this room. I turn around, and I don't see another black face in the whole place. And I view it as one of the most important moments of my life.
Jackson says he considered running back to Boston, but he stayed because he wanted to help future minority students not feel as alone and unsupported as he did that first day.
We started an organization called the Black Student Union. And why do I say it loud? Because it's the biggest and loudest name that we could have for seven people.
On a campus of 12,000 students, fewer than 100 were black. So the group demanded that UNH diversify its student body and staged a sit-in to press the case. Jackson eventually ran for student body president and won.
His agenda was not geared towards the African Americans, but it was geared towards everybody.
Malik Aziz was a college friend of Jackson's and a fellow member of the Black Student Union at UNH. He says back then, Jackson was something of a celebrity on campus, and that his campaign for student body president transcended race.
If it were a room full of 2 feet tall people, Tito would fit right in, and their issues would be his issues. He didn't limit himself by his race, which is a beautiful thing. It created an energy that made him pretty much an unstoppable force to know, and somebody that you wanted to know and wanted to love and wanted to be a friend of.
Jackson tried to exploit that same political talent in 2009. In his first run for the Boston City Council, he ran for an at-large seat. Stephanie Anderson Garrett managed the campaign and says Jackson worked hard to reach voters well beyond his political base in Roxbury.
He was determined to show up in places like South Boston. You know, he time and time again was committed to showing up and connecting with every part of the city.
He lost that race, but 2 years later won the District 7 seat, representing Roxbury, parts of Dorchester, the Fenway, and the South End. Now, Tito Jackson faces his biggest political challenge yet, to convince the voters of Boston that he can represent and lead the entire city.
All of that said, Boston is the greatest city in the world, but the question is, are we great for everyone?
That report about Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson from WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Now, you know, part of what Anthony brought up in his story is that there are many different views about what's best for Boston's future. Take, for example, the push to bring Amazon's second headquarters here. Now, a lot of cities are vying for that, in part because of the promise of 50,000 new jobs that would come with the Amazon HQ. But here in Boston, tech companies often say there's already a labor shortage. So would Amazon even be able to find those 50,000 talented Bostonians to fill those jobs? Well, Asma Khalid from WBUR's Bostonomics team has been asking local CEOs and venture capitalists this very question, and she joins us now. Hello, Asma.
Hey, Meghna.
Okay, so we've got a thriving startup scene, so maybe we ought to be thinking that finding talented tech people would be easy for Amazon.
You would, in theory, right?
In theory, yeah.
And so one guy I talked to described it this way. He said, you know, everybody wants to come to Boston because of the tech, but once they arrive, it's just really difficult to find the tech. I spoke with someone at iRobot who told me that they have over 60-plus vacancies at the moment right now, just for engineering, coding jobs. And I want you to listen to a bit of audio from Sarah Downey. She works at Accomplis, which is this VC firm based in Cambridge that invests in early stage companies.
Hiring is the number one problem for every portfolio company we have. And we have over 200, you know, so this is the thing that everyone is struggling with. Everyone's trying to hire engineers. Everyone's trying to retain engineers. It's very, very difficult. And there's a lot of competition.
I should have never left my engineering degree behind. I made the wrong decision. Now, what is responsible, though, for this labor shortage?
Well, Meghna, people say that there's a lot of people, obviously, students who come to Boston to get educated in the universities around here, but then inevitably they leave, often for the Bay Area, for the Bay Area, and that there's this sort of brain drain, and that in some ways maybe Amazon could help solve that problem. In fact, Tom Hopcroft, he's the CEO of the Massachusetts Tech Leadership Council, he made this very point.
A company like Amazon choosing to come here would, I think, cause more students who come through Massachusetts, 114 colleges and universities, to think of Massachusetts as the place to go after they graduate. They're all looking for that hot new tech hub where the opportunity is, where the future is being built. This would be so symbolic.
So, Meghna, it's sort of like Amazon in a lot of people's minds would offer this validation, this stamp of approval for Boston.
Okay. Well, so that's really interesting, though. But so here's the thing. You've been talking to local CEOs and local folks in the venture capital community. Say, for example, Boston did get the Amazon second headquarters. I mean, wouldn't that further make things difficult for those very same companies you were talking about? Because Amazon would be like sucking 50,000 people away from
them. Logically, you would think that. And I would say that, Meghna, I talked to a number of people for this story because I really wanted to get kind of like an accurate survey of the tech industry. And I would say a couple of people told me that, you know, they have this slight fear, this sort of dystopian vision that Amazon really could crush some smaller companies. But for the most part, everybody thought that things will be okay. Of course, one guy told me he would not want to be the HR of a mid-sized company, a company, say, like HubSpot, because he says that that's the real competition. So I asked the president of HubSpot, J.D. Sherman, what he thinks.
It would be a net positive. It would certainly be more competitive for positions. That's going to happen anyway, because I think the Boston tech scene is getting more and more vibrant. But I think having a big name like Amazon, I think that will help draw more talent to the area.
And Meghna, that is so sort of the similar opinion I also heard from Muhammad Ali. He's the CEO of Carbonite. It's this cloud backup service. He also, you know, sort of candidly says it will make things difficult, but...
Oh, it would make it very difficult for companies like Carbonite to hire. If you have an Amazon that is hiring 50,000 people. Having said that, I think we need to welcome innovative companies like Amazon to the Boston ecosystem. We need to actually invest in developing talent in Massachusetts. And if we use the Amazon relocation here to develop that talent, then it's a win-win for everyone.
So, Meghna, people like Mohammed will say that in theory, Amazon could be a draw to actually attract more tech workers to the city. And arguably, you know, people may work at Amazon and filter out of Amazon in a couple of years. It's not like every one of those 50,000 employees is an Amazon lifer.
Okay, so I can't resist asking. On the one hand, I feel like people in the tech sector are naturally optimistic, right? Because they're sort of in the business of helping create the future. So you have to have an optimism about that.
Sure.
And Boston has seen a significant tech renaissance. I mean, it's ongoing. So perhaps Amazon could be a major part, like a positive reinforcer of
that.
That's
what it sounds like, right? But there are certainly, you've got to think, going to be winners and losers if the labor market tightens. Yeah. And one company in particular that I really wanted to talk to you for this story is Wayfair. Wayfair is an e-commerce site, right? So they are in direct competition with Amazon in some ways. And
although I've talked to them before, they say they've kind of created a new market with what they do.
Yes, totally. But Meghna, for this story, they declined to comment. They were the only company that declined to comment that I reached out to.
Okay. And also, from these other folks that you spoke to, so this is the cynical journalist in me. I'm just going to throw this at you. Did you get the feeling that no one wants to be the person to say,
yes,
no, Amazon should not come?
Yes. I will say no one wants to be that person, in part that I would say to me it was very interesting that Wayfair, who initially said, you know, write us some questions in email and we'll even try to get those responses back. I got an email back late last night from them saying, we've decided not to comment on this story. And in my mind, if there was one company that was really going to try to put the brakes and say, hey, this actually could be worrisome for our tech workforce, right? It would likely be a company like Wayfair. And to me, it was very interesting that they didn't want to comment. And look, Meghna, I get that it will make the ecosystem tougher, I think, for certain individual companies. But what I think is interesting is whether you talk to the CEO of iRobot, Carbonite, the head of HubSpot, people are saying it's good for the overall ecosystem here. And to me, that's something that's, you know, look, I'm new to the beat in Boston here covering tech, but it's something that I have found kind of continuously in my coverage of tech in Boston that sort of makes this ecosystem somewhat unique is that I do think in many ways it's more collaborative than right. other cities.
I also wonder if there's an analogy to, like, say, the healthcare sector. Like, I don't hear anyone say, well, MGH shouldn't be here, or Beth Israel should not be here, or, you know, like, all these big hospitals. We've got a ton of them. No one's saying, well, we shouldn't have so many. Like, there's a reinforcing culture there, too.
And Meghna, though, I will say, one of, I guess, the biggest concerns I've actually heard from people is that Boston is on this up and up, right, in terms of being sort of having this moment of a tech renaissance, and that if people choose to put the brakes on innovation, if people say, hey, we've got enough, just don't bid for Amazon, that would actually be really detrimental to the city. I spoke with Russ Wilcox. He's a partner at Pillar Venture Capital. Fun fact, he also actually worked at the company that helped commercialize the ink that is on all Amazon Kindles. So he has experience with Amazon and really what he believes Amazon could do for this city. And so he talked to me a bit about the labor market and overall the tech ecosystem.
I think what's happening in the world is that is increasingly a winner-take-all economics. So that means that whoever's the best in the profession is very hard to find and very expensive to find, and whoever's second best basically loses out. So we're increasingly in this kind of race. And it is scary, but also that's the reality of how our economics works now. And the same thing is true for Boston. We are either one of the top three cities in the world for innovation, or we are irrelevant.
That's harsh.
It is very ominous.
Okay, but I'm going to say that I hope that this drives us all to get, you know, more, to build our workforce here. Regardless, right? We're already having a labor shortage for tech.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get more people qualified to fill those jobs.
All right.
She's just shaking her head like, yes, but let's think about Amazon first. Okay, that's Asma Khalidji's head of WBUR's Bostonomics team, talking to us about what the local tech and venture capital community thinks about the possibility of Amazon putting its second headquarters here in Boston. Asma, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Ken Burns and Lynn Novick's PBS documentary, The Vietnam War, opens with what may be the one indisputable truth about the war. It's uttered by Marine Carl Morlantis.
Coming home from Vietnam was close to as traumatic as the war itself. For years, nobody talked about Vietnam. We were friends with a young couple, and it was only after 12 years that the two wives were talking. Found out that we both had been Marines in Vietnam. Never said a word about it, never mentioned it. And the whole country was like that. It was so divisive. And it's like living in a family with an alcoholic father. Shh, we don't talk about that.
The final episode of the 10-part, 18-hour documentary airs tonight, and people are most certainly talking. Joining us now is Ken Burns. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Lynn Novick. Ms. Novick, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much.
Well, I have to say, it's a great honor to have both of you because you've accomplished something tremendous with this series. And Ken, if I could just first start with you. We're at the tail end of it now. What kind of reaction have you been hearing from folks who've been watching?
I think that it's been what we hoped it would be. That is to say, a necessary conversation about a war that many of us sort of preferred to ignore or preferred to sort of sit comfortably with our own rather superficial conceptions and arguments about what it was. And most heartening is just little anecdotal things of people saying, you know, my dad started talking for the first time and about this. And that, you know, that to us is the best review of all.
Yeah, you know, it's been extraordinary to see just the conversation on social media and on Facebook and people emailing and texting and just the way that people communicate now in the moment as the film is unfolding on television and afterwards. And we keep on seeing over and over again, I didn't know that. And, you know, we felt the same way making the film. And, you know, people who live through it, you know the part of it that you saw, but you couldn't possibly have the perspective of 40 or 50 years. And hearing the Vietnamese voices seems to be quite revelatory for Americans. And it's also devastating because of what's going on in the world today, because of the tremendous losses and the tragic implications. It sort of feels like a reckoning with something that we have needed to do for a long time.
Absolutely. And I think there's two things in what you just said, which are the exact reasons why I find the documentary so utterly essential right now. And one of them is the inclusion of all those Vietnamese voices, like the voice of Bao Ninh. He was a member of the North Vietnamese Army. And let's listen to a clip from the documentary where he speaks. And Bao Ninh is saying, even the Vietnamese veterans, we avoid talking about the war. People sing about victory, about liberation. They're wrong. Who won and who lost is not a question. In war, no one wins or loses. There's only destruction. Only those who have never fought argue about who won and lost. Ken and Lynn, I just wonder, could you take us through your journey in bringing those voices, voices like Bao Ninh, to American audiences?
I think that Americans have really not dealt with Vietnam. And when we have, we just told stories about ourselves. And we have done what wars do, which is objectify the other almost to the point that they disappear. And I think one of the great flaws in our approach over many decades and many presidential administrations from Truman through Nixon is that we actually, from the very beginning on, never really cared to know about our enemy and our ally. We didn't want to know about their history, which would have taught us an extraordinary amount. We didn't think that the French experience would in any way be duplicated with us. We weren't interested in their culture, their language, and there was a kind of hubris and arrogance that we felt it was important to belie just by the presence of other people's testimony. And what's so interesting is that the soldiers, North Vietnamese soldiers or Viet Cong guerrillas or American Marines or American Army guys, sound exactly alike.
And Lynn, how did you find these voices?
We found people in Vietnam and in the United States pretty much the same way, really, through word of mouth, through things people had written, through newspaper articles, through veterans organizations. And so people were eager to share their stories with us because they haven't had that opportunity before, and they wanted their children and grandchildren to know what they went through, to understand the kind of sacrifice and privations and horrors of the war. And it's causing, to some degree, a kind of reckoning with the war there as well, because the film has been translated into Vietnamese and streaming on PBS in English, Spanish, and Vietnamese, and it's streaming in Vietnam. And hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions, are watching it right now, same as Americans. And they're having some of the same kind of conversations Ken was just speaking about.
You know, the other, I think, when I think about the series as a whole, its great power and its importance harkens back to something you said a minute or two ago, Lynn, that while on the one hand we've spent decades not talking honestly about the Vietnam War, it is one of the defining conflicts in terms of America's view of itself and in the world. And I mean, I'm looking at remembering the title of the first episode, Deja Vu. It seems as if we've had deja vu about Vietnam again and again and again. Iraq, Afghanistan, who knows what's going to happen on the Korean Peninsula again. This, how much of that was sort of on your minds as filmmakers when you were making this documentary? Because it seems as if perhaps the many lessons of Vietnam we as a nation haven't yet learned.
You know, it's funny. The deja vu for us referred to the fact that there were all these warning signs of the French experience that were exactly what was going to happen to us, which we picked up none of those signals and heeded none of those warnings. And so for us, taking the French phrase deja vu was a way of saying, you know, everything that you see in episode one is going to be replicated in episodes 2 through 10. When the film is done, though, we begin to realize, as we have with every film that we have made, that it echoes in the present. The ghosts are there. And so it's you know, Mark Twain said that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And, you know, we lifted our heads up when we finished this film and saw an abundance of rhymes.
Right. And Lynn, what's your thought about that?
Oh, yeah, no, I don't think I can add much to that. I've just been thinking about, you know, the impact of the film today. And one of the things that's so disturbing to all of us or many people is just this sort of toxic disunion, and we're in our separate camps and you're either right or wrong, you're either with us or against us and good and bad. And we're living in this very bifurcated situation that's very unnerving because, as we've discovered in making this film, reality is a lot more gray and nuanced and mixed. And one of the things that's come across in the reaction to the film is just the sense, you know, what we've tried to do, and I think that's one reason why the film is resonating, is we have honored the soldiers who served. They were not responsible for the policies and for the military strategy. But we've also tried to honor the people who thought the war was wrong and protested against it and tried to stop it. And that's a very important part of being American and being patriotic. And it challenged our notion of who we are in the world in a really productive and positive way. And so, you know, we hope our film, like Ken was saying, there's room for these really important and nuanced perspectives to exist. And it's very powerful.
Well, can you tell me a little bit more about that? Because, I mean, you talk to so many people whose lives were defined by this war. I mean, what was that like? It must be hours and hours and hours.
What happens is you say a film about a war and you presume that all the conflict is between armies. And it is, but it's also within individuals. And so we knew that we couldn't just end the war, have Saigon fall in 75, and then roll the credits. Mm-hmm. That the back half of the last episode tonight is really going to be, how do you understand what's taken place since the fall of Saigon, the 52 years, literally up to the present, that's gone on? How do you deal with the soldiers and their ghosts? How do you bring about reconciliation? How do you judge the war? What lessons were taken from? What is Vietnam like now? What is America doing in the interim? All of these things became a necessary part of the narrative of a war that ended sort of very definitively and finally at the end of April 1975, but as is very clear within these individuals, continues to rage to this day.
And Lynn, you spoke to so many people in making this documentary, but there's one in particular I want to ask you more about. Roger Harris, he's a veteran from Roxbury who later became principal of the Timilty Middle School in Roxbury. And first of all, here's a clip of him from the film.
Well, I was there, I had the opportunity to call my mother, you know. And I was telling my mother what was happening over there, and I was telling her how she shouldn't believe what she sees in the newspaper and or sees on television because we're losing the war. I said, you'll probably never see me again because we're the most northern outpost that the Marines have. You know, we could literally could look right into Vietnam. We could see the sparks when the guns fired on us. And I said, everybody in my unit's dying. I probably won't be coming back. And my mother said, no, you're coming back. She said, I talk to God every day, and you're special. Yeah, you're coming back. And I said, Ma, everybody's mother thinks that they're special. You know, I'm putting pieces of special people in bags.
That's Roger Harris. Tell us more about him.
Well, yes, we feel so grateful to know him. And, you know, he has not spoken about the war that much before, like many people in the film. And he was very generous to really tell us what it was like in Con Tien, in the Marines, going to Vietnam, and then coming home. And his coming home story is so poignant, you know, having served his year in Vietnam, barely survived, and then getting out of the airport in Boston at Logan, he couldn't get a cab. And he realized it was because he was African-American and he's wearing his uniform. And just what that meant and him his explaining that is a very, very important moment in our history. And, you know, he has gone on to live an extraordinarily productive life. He said that he made a vow to himself when he was in Vietnam that if he survived the war, he would do something worthwhile with his life to make it, you know, to make up for all the people, his friends who died. And he became a great educator. And, yeah, we cannot imagine what our film would be like if he were not part of it.
The film is such a vast undertaking that obviously we're not going to we're barely scratching the surface here. But if I may, can I just ask both of you two more quick questions? And the first is that, in fact, because of its vastness and your decade-long efforts in treating this definitive moment in world history, let alone American history, with such delicacy and complexity, what's your response to some critics who say that very delicacy and complexity may absolve some people of their deep responsibility for the destruction that the war wrought. I mean, there's still many people, some of whom fought in Vietnam, who say, we should have never been there to begin with.
And their voices are represented throughout the film. I just think that we've both made a conscious decision in our professional lives to trust the intelligence of our audience, to provide them with the facts as far as we can ascertain from years and years of meticulous work, and only those who want to see this in purely stark black and white terms will feel discomfort at our presentation, because at almost every turn in the film, we will see that a thing and the opposite of a thing are true at the same time.
Touché. I completely agree 100% with everything Ken just said. The only thing I would just add, there's a sense of lack of accountability that recurs through the film, and it's very important. And we call it out at many junctures that, you know, sometimes terrible things are done and no one seems to get punished.
It just happens to be bipartisan criticism.
Right.
And so it doesn't always conveniently fit into a narrative of left or right. Because, you know, when Richard Nixon does something smart and right, we say that was smart and that was right. When he has a piece of tape where it's not so right, it's pretty clear there, too.
Right. So my last question for you, bear with me for a moment as I muddle through it, okay?
Okay.
Because I just wanted to share with you a feeling that I had watching, not as a journalist, but just as an American. And here's why. I'm 41, and I don't have any direct family members who were involved in the war. The closest I personally ever came to it was one of my best friends in middle school and high school was born in 1975. His mother basically did everything she could to hold on to her unborn child while they were being evacuated from Saigon. Mm-hmm. And she gave birth at a U.S. a base. He's named after the base that he was born at. But even them, and I've known my friend and his family for most of my life, never talked about his family's experience.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So here I am watching this film and just being utterly amazed by the voices, the people, the complexities, the terrible decisions, the courageous acts. I could actually bring myself to understand every point of view that you presented. And how, you know what I come away feeling at the end of it? I'm sorry to say this, but I come away with this profound melancholy, because mm-hmm. I keep thinking to myself, there are U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq right now who are living this very same experience. There are Iraqi civilians and Afghanis living this very same experience. I cannot be optimistic about that rhyming nature of history.
Yeah.
That's how I feel.
I agree. We feel that we've succeeded. How could you take this devastating information, not just about Americans, but about the human race and our inability to see what we do to each other? We'd love to have made a film just about the back half of episode 10, which is all about how people get along and how they reconcile differences. But that's just not what happens with us.
But you told Terry Gross, what, a week ago, that being a historian or making these films has made you an optimist.
It has, and I'm optimistic for this way. I think that we are obligated as artists, from time to time, depending on the subjects that we are drawn to describe hell. And that's really, really important. And artists have, through time, done that. I believe equally that it is our responsibility to describe how you get out of that hell. And while the roadmap is not definitive and clear here, it's there. And what I see and what makes me an optimist is that these things, yes, they do rhyme. Human nature remains the same. We will commit the same follies. But we also find ways to recover. And something is accrued. And I believe, as George Will said in our Roosevelt series of 3 years ago, that he felt that Franklin Roosevelt believed that history was a rising road. However imperceptible that rise is, it is better.
Yeah, one hopes, because I can't stop thinking about how we need to get there faster. There's too many times where the powerful just grind up the powerless.
Well, impatience is a really good goad to evolution.
I this is a really painful, deeply tragic story. And we had to come through this extraordinary sort of cauldron of just, like Ken said, hell, and come out the other end with a more adult understanding of human nature, of ourselves, of what we can and can't do in the world. And our leaders haven't held on to that because new generations come along, like Ken said, and they can't necessarily, they have to keep on learning the same lessons again. But, you know, what choice do we have? We have to tell this story to ourselves.
Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, filmmakers behind the PBS documentary The Vietnam War, thank you so much for your work, and it's been a true privilege to speak with you. Thank you both.
Thank you, Megan.
Thank you. Thank you.
And the final episode of The Vietnam War airs tonight on PBS. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Thank you so much for listening. This is Radio Boston.